So yes, as Nyanvacha said in the first half, we're going to be carrying on with this drop-in seminar, looking at two things which go together very well. A lecture called The Greater Mandala, and a seminar extract called The Bitendential Value of Being. So that those two together make up the subject for a whole 5 weeks. And I too want to just really recommend this to you. I know Nyanvacha did already. I'm so delighted that we've printed this. It literally just arrived from the printers about an hour before the class. I was so happy. The lectures, it's not exactly that it's been out of print, but it's been in print, but inside some sort of very sort of huge volume. So we really wanted it to be available that you could just like pick up, you know, to go with the course. And I'm really pleased that it's been done so beautifully. And so I'm pleased that it's so accessible. And it really is, I think, out of all my lectures that I've read by Bhante Sangharakshita, our founder and my own teacher, it's like definitely my favourite lecture. And sometimes I think to myself, if I'd read this lecture every day before I went to work, my life would be totally different. And actually some of my friends would probably be quite relieved if I did, because it is, it's a bit, you know, it really, this lecture just really encourages us to live in quite a different way than our sort of habitual way of being for most of us. I mean, I don't know about you, but more and more I've been realizing when I wake up in the morning, that I wake up and I think I've probably got a few instants of feeling quite spacious and quite, you know, a sense of even wonder and mystery, but that lasts so short I can hardly even remember it. And then the feeling is as if I just kind of gather myself into this little ball and then kind of hurl myself at the day. and that's, you know, that's what I call being alive in a way. Most of my first meditation of the day is trying to sort of already undo that. You know, it's happened in the half hour between I've got up and I've got into the shrine. I've already like gather myself into this little ball to sort of throw at the world in a way. And this notion of living in what Bhante's called the greater mandala, it completely undoes that. And what Nyanvacha was saying last week, it was very, very interesting, because Nyanvacha gave us the context of when this lecture was given, which is really, really important. It's very interesting with Bhante. He died last year, as many of you will know, and he hadn't been teaching much in the last number of years in his life. He died when he was 93, so he was very old. But during the whole time he founded the movement and set it up, all his talks and lectures, they were responsive to what was happening. I mean, it was kind of before my time. Ashwajit and David Mitchell remember this. It wasn't just that he had a whole list of things that he was going to give and then he just did them one after the other. He would be seeing what was happening in this movement he'd founded and what he needed to say. And often what he'd be saying would be a sort of corrective in a way to what was happening. You know, he'd be attending to things. And anyway, this lecture he gave round about the time this Buddhist centre was being built, which was a huge, massive undertaking, and nearly the whole resources of the whole movement were going into it. Now we've got centres all over the place, but at that time, 40 years ago, this was the major project. You know, this whole place being built from scratch by sort of complete dedicated but amateurs, you know, who didn't really know how to build, you know. And there's all sorts of stories about the gas pipe and the water pipe getting mixed up and, you know, water coming out of the cooker and stuff like that. Anyway, so, you know, a tremendous big building project. And in the middle of this, when everybody's working, you know, so that, you know, so tired that they could barely even eat their evening meal, you know, so like exhausted. And Bhante gave this lecture in which he was saying that the wisdom of the Buddha, the Buddha's wisdom, would actually be relishing uselessness, that being human is enough. You don't have to have a goal. You don't have to be doing stuff all the time. And you can imagine, I don't know, it's hard to imagine quite how that would have gone down, really, for the people to hear that at the time. You know, hear all these people trying to build this centre, trying to really ardently create the conditions for the Dharma to flourish. I mean, very, very good, and very, very, well, we're very grateful to them, and very, very worthy. And here's Bhante saying that an enlightened being's attitude to life would be to not take everything so seriously, that ideally life should be play. The Buddhist word is lila. It's quite interesting to think, well, what would it be like if you were one of those builders and you heard that? So that's the context. But then Jnanavacha was, you know, at some pains to point out that this doesn't mean that an enlightened being, a bodhisattva, is just all about navel gazing. You know, I think some people, I don't know if it's still, there's a phrase that goes around, but for a while there was a sort of, people used to say just be, you know, or talk about being rather than doing. But actually, that's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha, as far as we know, didn't ever say just be. So that's interesting. So on one hand, the wisdom of the Buddha would be not to take everything so deadly seriously. The bodhisattvas, we're told, goes through life with this quality of lila, of play. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean it's all about navel gazing and not actually doing anything. That's what I want to carry on exploring. One more thing Jnanavacha said, just to elaborate on that last week. He said that this wisdom of the Buddha isn't escapism, yeah? So, yeah, I mean, that's just an elaboration on it. It isn't sort of navel gazing. It isn't sort of leaving the world behind. You engage with suffering. The Buddha, the Bodhisattva, engages with suffering, but isn't knocked off course by that. Isn't, you might say, dragged down by it. Isn't their own equilibrium, isn't sort of knocked by that. It's like, well, in a way, it's kind of sort of speaks for itself, isn't it? Because if you engage in suffering in such a way that you are knocked off course, then you actually are not able to help, you know, you actually make the problem worse. So it's more like the Buddha or Bodhisattva transcends the smallness, yeah? And that's what I want to carry on exploring this evening. And what I wanted to really start off by reflecting on is these two images on the shrine. We introduced them last week. They're our sort of emblems for the course, our symbols for the course. So the figure, the smaller figure sitting on the moon mat of the Buddha is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And then the larger painting is Ratnasambhava, the Buddha of beauty. Very, very apt for what we're talking about. And both of these are archetypal figures. We have the larger figure representing the historical Buddha, and then you have these archetypal figures depicting, embodying qualities of the enlightened mind, different aspects. So I wanted to just look at them, particularly their gestures, because I think it can start to give us some clues in the sort of what this quality of wisdom is, because it's impossible actually to put into words. So we'll start with Avalokiteshvara. So the first thing you'll notice is that Avalokiteshvara has got four arms. And so two are joined here, and then two are holding ritual implements. So in one of these outstretched hands, I think it's the left one, he is holding a lotus, which is a very, very, very evocative symbol in Buddhism and represents the growth and the naturalness of growth, a sort of unfolding. Yeah, that's one way we can see our Dharma lives, as a natural unfolding. And there's a lot that could be said about the lotus, but what I wanted to talk more about the mala, or rosary, that's in the other hand of Avalokiteshvara. So, you know, you'll be familiar with a mala. It's a sort of string of prayer beads, you could say, that people say mantras on throughout the ages. And it's interesting that you haven't just got that in Buddhism. Lots of different religions have got rosaries or beads in which people tell prayers or tell mantras. I'm going to my aunt's funeral tomorrow, and that'll be a Catholic funeral, and I know that as part of that there'll be the rosary. You know, we'll be going round, you know, praying on a set of beads. So you've got this mala held in the hands of Avalokiteshvara, and he, as I was saying, is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And sometimes what is said, that as he's sort of telling these through his fingers, that every bead represents a suffering being that he's saving, which is a rather beautiful image. But then I was thinking, well, just the mala, it's round, isn't it? You'd never come to an end, yeah? So yes, there's Avalokiteshvara, like saving beings, as it were, symbolically saving beings, by, you know, telling these beads. But actually, when you get to the end, it isn't an end, it's just a beginning again, yeah? So the beings to be saved are limitless. But also, exactly simultaneously with that, his prayers on the mala are limitless, yeah? So neither are ending. So beings are limitless. Beings to be saved are limitless. But then the mantra chanting never ends either. So I think this is a symbol for keep engaging. It's just that Avalokiteshvara would just keep engaging, kind of without needing to have an end in sight. I think that's quite an important point, because I think we unenlightened, we want there to be an end. We want to say, okay, well, you know, I've been working quite hard by now, like, isn't everybody safe by now, you know? But actually the truth is that it will never come to an end. That samsara is endless. It will never come to an end. You see, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that can seem like a discouraging thought, but when I was reflecting on this, I had a little glimpse of, oh, there's a sort of freedom in that as well, because you don't have to think, okay, only another 100,000 mantras to go and I'll have saved everyone. You know, all you can do is keep engaging, you know. You're not thinking about the end of it. You're just thinking, well, I'll just keep engaging. As long as they're suffering, I'll keep engaging. So I think that's the symbolism of the mala. You keep engaging. But then, of course, there's these two hands in the middle, joined in reverence. And what they're holding, as we heard last week, is a jewel. And the jewel represents, it's called, what's sometimes called the Chintamani, and also the Bodhicitta. The jewel is kind of the will to enlightenment itself in its fullest form. It's also called, which I really meditate upon a lot, it's also called the wish-fulfilling jewel. So it's the jewel that fulfills all skillful wishes. again, there's a whole talk in itself in that, because, you know, just this notion of the wish-fulfilling duo, you know, so much the subject of so many, even in Western literature, so many fairy tales and so on, just this object that can fulfill all wishes. And of course, in the fairy tales, the catch is always that people don't know what to wish for, and they wish for the wrong thing, and it all kind of goes wrong. The message being, of course, something like, if we really knew what to wish for, we would be enlightened already on the spot, you know. So that this is this wish-fulfilling jewel, and it's held to his heart, yeah. So you've got, so immediately you can see you've got something interesting. You've got these forearms. Two are held to the heart. Two are, you could say, are the sort of inward-looking gesture, the prayer gesture, the, you know, that the sort of deepening of the heart. And two of the hands are sort of outward going. There's the lotus representing the growth of all beings. There's this mala representing the saving of all beings. And I want to come back to the relationship between these sort of inner hands, as it were, and these outer hands. And I think in the figure of Ratnasambhava, you see the same thing, but in a way more simply. Ratnasambhava's just got two hands, and what you have is, in one hand, again, you've got the jewel. You've got this wish-fulfilling jewel held right at the centre of his being. And then the other hand is outstretched in generosity. So you've got the same sort of thing. You've got a sort of inward movement, and then you've got an outward movement at the same time. And I've meditated on this figure of Ratnasambhava particularly for about the last 25 years or so, ever since my ordination. Before that, actually, I was also meditating, but sort of more formally meditating since my ordination. And, you know, fascinating to meditate on these figures, because there's so much more in the symbolism. And, you know, and what was often said to me, and what people often say about this gesture of Ratnasambhava, is people often say something like, well, it's because he's got this wish-fulfilling jewel held, you know, right in the centre of his being, that enables this endless giving, yeah? That enables this endless giving of the outstretched hand. You know, you've got the jewel, so you're always replenished, so you can always keep giving, yeah? But I think, yes, that's not untrue, but I think what's more subtle and more profound is that the same must be true the other way around, yeah? That because of the endless giving, that's what in a way is creating, that's not quite the right word, but creating the wish-fulfilling jewel, yeah? So it's not just that you can give because you have the jewel, it's that you have the jewel because you're constantly giving, yeah? And that's the same with Avalokiteshvara as well, yeah? It's not just that you can save all beings because you're holding the jewel to your heart, it's that because you're saving all beings, that the jewel sort of crystallizes out of that that momentum, yeah. So what I've been reflecting on more and more recently is, with many of these archetypal figures, you've got this seemingly opposing gesture. You've got an outward and an inward. But what I've been reflecting on is that, from their point of view, like, if you were Ratnasambhava, if you were Avalokiteshvara, that would be the same gesture. Yeah, from our point of view, it looks like they're doing opposing things, that one hand holding this jewel inwardly and one hand reaching out. That's what it looks like to us, because we are unenlightened. If we are unenlightened, if you're enlightened, you'll see that that's the same gesture. If you're unenlightened, it'll look different, even opposing. But from their point of view, it's the same gesture, yeah? It's the same gesture. So I think that's, and I think that's a wonderful image of, it's a kind of, it's the deepest sort of harmony possible, yeah? It's when you realise that wisdom and compassion are not they're the same thing, just looked at from different points of view. So so that's, I think that was following on from Jnanavacha's reflection on the wisdom of the bodhisattvas isn't turning away from the world, but it's not identifying with the smallness. Yeah, it's bigger, and because it's bigger, it can respond. And this is what we're trying to do. This is what we're trying to move towards. I mean, I think even as a human wish, I think it is an amazing wish. You know, even if you don't even mention Buddhism, just to be able to respond to the cries of the world, but in a way that is joyful, in a way that's lila. I said another little example on a more sort of human level. Just the other day, I was on retreat with Subhuti, who's the president of the centre here. Some of you will know him. And I was on a study retreat up at one of our retreat centres. Anyway, he was giving a talk every day on this retreat, but he'd made a mistake and he wasn't supposed to be there. He was supposed to be on a 6-month solitary retreat, and he already had done 4.5 months of that retreat. And either he or the person who looks after his diary made a mistake and put him down for this retreat. And I think he temporarily tried to see if he could wriggle his way out of doing this retreat, but then actually his better self got the better of him and he realized, no, I must do this retreat, I've committed to it. And he turned up on this retreat and he looked amazing. You know, for a start he looked like really glowing and very youthful, in spite of his 70 odd years. And what he said was really interesting. He said, I'm giving the talks, I'm really happy to do it, he said, but I'm going to keep quite quiet. I'm not really going to engage with all of you on the retreat that much. There was about 40 or so of us on the retreat. He said, I'm just going to, stay in my room where I am and so on. But what was really interesting to me, he said, it's not that I don't want to engage with you, and it's not that I couldn't engage with you. He said, it's not that I'm feeling, oh, I'm so sensitive, I've just been on my own for 4.5 months, I can't sort of bear the light of day of coming out into the world. He said, I just want to keep my mind quite quiet. He said, I just want to, if I start talking to everyone, I'll enjoy it so much that my mind won't be quiet. So he was doing it by choice, and I thought there's a real message in that, which in a way ties in, I think, with what I'm trying to say, and that to me, Subhuti was like the play of the bodhisattva. He could be on retreat totally alone for 4.5 months. Perfectly happy doing that, but then if he's called to come and give a talk every day for like 5 days to a bunch of 30 or 40 people, he can just seamlessly move into that without having some big sort of, oh, I'm so precious and tender, I've been on retreat, I can't do that, and then he can just go back into his retreat again. To me, that was very, very eloquent, that the way that he could do that, apart from the fact he gave us some amazing talks, just the fact he could just move out and move in, yeah? I probably couldn't do that. If I'd been silent for 4.5 months, I would probably, I wouldn't be able to so seamlessly move out and give those talks and then go back in again. But just something about the way he did that, I thought, oh yeah, that's what I aspire to. That's what I aspire to. It reminded me of something a good friend of me said a long time ago about sometimes at the end of a long retreat, people feel a little nervous about leaving the retreat. And sometimes they express that by saying, oh yeah, it's going to be a bit difficult going out and to, face the world, as it were. I'm feeling a bit too open. Whatever that means, a bit, but somehow that's the way they express it. I'm feeling to go out into the world. And she said, if you're feeling that you can't go out into the world after a retreat, it's not that you're too open, it's that you're not open enough. And I just thought that was very, very good. And in a way, seeing that in Subhuti. So anyway, I better move on. So basically what we're trying to do is cultivate this such a responsiveness that these gestures, as it were, would be the exact same thing. We wouldn't feel a dissonance between outward or inward, on retreat or off retreat, meeting suffering or just simply happily enjoying the beauties of nature. Yeah. And I think this, I really like this word responsiveness and this, well, not just that, I like the word, I like the notion of responsiveness as what we're trying to cultivate. Because I think if we think of that as what we're trying to cultivate, it'll help us. If we think of what we're trying to cultivate in terms of responsiveness, it'll help us to know what we're trying to do. And what I mean when I talk about responsiveness is we're trying to work towards a state of being, a sort of unified state of being, basically, yeah? So where our mind, our head, if you like, our heart and our actions aren't just sort of in relation to each other, but they're sort of unified into a whole, yeah? So we'd experience ourselves as more and more whole. There won't be a conflict between what my head tells me I should be doing and what my heart says I should be doing and what I'm actually doing. Yeah, ununified, which is most of the time for me, all those three things are sort of not on the same page. Yeah? I know what I should be doing. My heart says another thing. My actions are doing something else again. Yeah. A unified state of mind is they're all acting together and responding in a holistic way to the world, yeah? And that's what, in a way, that's, well, for me, that's what I'm meditating for, if I can be said to meditate for anything. And I possibly should say as well, although on one hand I'm saying that often I'm experiencing them as separate, I do feel with practice over the years that there has been more, they have come into unity more than they used to be. Yeah. So as I practice, they've come into unity more, and sometimes, not always, I do experience them coming together very, very well indeed. And then life feels, well, like just like a joy, actually. Then life feels like, you know, just effortless, yeah? Life feels effortless when those three things come together. Because you don't have to force yourself in a direction you don't want to go, yeah? So I think our task is to cultivate this faculty of responsiveness, yeah? We do have it within us. We have this within us. But it emerges more and more as we cultivate more and more skillful action, for example. By skillful action, of course, I don't mean just doing good. I mean something much more subtle and when we've got much more of our intelligence to bear on things. Yeah. And I think it's important to say that we've all experienced this as well. And we might have experienced it in quite simple ways. When I'm talking about this kind of everything coming together, I sometimes think of it as something like, you know that experience where you find the exact right birthday present for somebody? You're so happy, aren't you? You're so... In a funny way, you're probably even more happier than they are receiving it, although hopefully they are receiving it. So I think it's that kind of experience, the experience that you feel when you think, oh, that's just them, you know? And I think quite a lot of things come together at that moment, but it's very, very intuitive, isn't it? You've been thinking about the person, you want to give them something, presumably because you love and appreciate them, and then that thing seems just so much them. There's just a particular joy in finding that present. You see, I think that's what Bodhisattva must feel like all the time, when they're helping beings. So they're not really, well, we think of them as helping beings, you know. We might look at a Bodhisattva or a Bodhisattva-like being and think, oh, you know, they're so compassionate. But actually, that Bodhisattva's feeling like they've just found the exact right birthday present for everyone. Do you see what I mean? It's natural to them. They're not thinking, oh, I'm so compassionate. Oh, I'm not feeling I'm so being so good. They're feeling that feeling that we feel when we just find that present, or we're able to help someone in the way they want us to help them. Yeah. Does everybody know that sort of feeling? Yeah. So I think that's important that we've at least had glimpses of that. And could you imagine feeling like that all the time towards everyone? Well, maybe even if we can't quite imagine it, can you imagine that even could be possible? Sort of, maybe. It's attractive, isn't it? And how that would be just a joy. People would experience you as giving to them, just as your friend really happy that you've given them the present. But you would just be experiencing it as a joy, yeah? So one thing I would suggest is really try and identify that when it does happen, yeah? And really try and see that is a faculty we've all got, yeah? And then what we need to do is learn how to cultivate that, yeah? And we need to learn to cultivate it and let it, what we're trying to do in our life, in our Dharma life, but in our whole life, is try and let that sort of state of being be the thing that everything comes from, yeah? And I think that's what Bantu was trying to do when he was, well, I'm guessing that's what he was trying to do when he gave that lecture right in the midst of everybody being so busy trying to build the Buddha Center. Because if all they had done was build the Buddha Center, well, that would have been great, and we'd probably still be sitting here benefiting from it. Well, maybe we would. Hard to know what would have happened, but say they had still built it, say they had just got more and more, right, got to get it done, like me with my sort of ball of myself that I'm hurling at the world. If they had done that, a Buddha Centre probably would have got built. But if it hadn't had this bigger perspective, it would have just been a building. Do you see what I mean? It would have been what Bhante says elsewhere, I think, in a sense, a spectacular failure, yeah? You'd still have had something spectacular, you know, this Buddha Centre built out of this old burnt-out fire station. But if it had only been done by sheer effort of will, without any glimpse of this bigger perspective, from a Dharmic point of view, it's a failure, yeah? It would have been a failure. No matter how many good works we do in life, if we don't try and have this bigger perspective, if we don't cultivate this faculty, then actually we, even our greatest sort of achievements, even if we've, I don't know what we've done, we may have done very great and noble things, they're sort of a spectacular failure. Because we're not doing the real work, which isn't work at all in a way. Maybe another way of putting this, another way I was reflecting on this, because we've been talking quite a lot about doing nothing and we've been practicing just sitting. Doing nothing takes it even a step further. Jnanavacha was encouraging us last week just to find some minutes to do nothing in, not to try and be useful in any way, not to try and be useful in any way, not to try and be doing something for something, not to try and be engaging with life in a utilitarian way at all. So Jnanavacha was encouraging us just to sit in an armchair, say, and do nothing. And it's hard to do that. I must confess, I don't do it nearly as much as I talk about doing it, because it's very hard to do it. And I think what you're doing when you're doing nothing, perhaps a way of putting it is you're practicing not being needed. Yeah, you're practicing sort of not justifying your existence by being useful. I'm thinking maybe that's an extension of the doing nothing practice. It's the not being needed practice. Yeah, practice not being needed. And I think, paradoxically, that in order to be useful, we have to be able to not be useful, if you see what I mean. Otherwise, what we're doing is I'm trying to avoid using the word neurotic, but there you go, I've used it. However good we're trying to be, we're doing it to sort of actually fill some need in ourselves. If we can't be useless, we can't be useful, because then it all is actually serving our own sort of end. So we have to, I think it'd be really good to every day practice being useless, and even useless kind of to ourselves. I think this is what Jnanavacha is meaning when he's saying don't meditate for anything. So practice not being needed. The other thing to practice, I think, is allowing ourselves to be moved. This is me taking it on to a slightly different type, but if we're going to cultivate this responsiveness, it has to come from a place of being useless, but also, I think, allow ourselves to be moved. I mean, why I say that is sometimes strange that I don't allow myself to be moved. I feel a little bit of being moved, then I think, oh no, don't get all sentimental or something. Don't get all soppy or something, that, do you ever get that where you're, I don't know, I often get it when I'm reading a novel, I find myself moved to tears by the carriage, and then I think, oh, so better, it's only made up, don't be so, and actually I have to actively allow myself, I think it's an actual practice to me to allow myself to be moved, and especially allow myself to be moved by, just the generosity of other people, the bravery of other people, the kindness of other people. We can practice allowing ourselves to be moved. So what I've been saying so far is that all our sort of useful activity, and we isn't, again to repeat, that we're not saying don't engage with the world, but all our useful activity needs to be contained in the bigger sphere of uselessness, And again, Jnanavacha said last week, the essence of this is mystery, So we're moving into a realm where there's a sort of lack of closedness, An openness to mystery, openness to possibility. There's a Buddhist word you may have heard, is shunyata. It's sometimes translated as emptiness, which isn't exactly a wrong translation, but it's a bit misleading translation. It means empty of constructs and so on. But I think a better way to think about shunyata, perhaps, is that shunyata is the principle that there is nothing that is not possible. It represents a complete absence of restrictions on the possibilities of being. The image for it is the blue sky. So all our useful activities in this bigger sphere of this principle, even principle isn't quite the right word, but we'll do for now, that there's nothing that is not possible. Yeah, it's in the blue sky. All our useful activities in the blue sky. Of course, the Buddhas and Bodhisattva figures emerge from the blue sky. They're always shown in the blue sky, emerging from it and sort of disappearing into it. Of course, when they disappear, it's not that they've gone. It's that they're there in potential all the time. Yeah, that's where they emerge from, and that's where they sort of disappear into. So that's the context, yeah, that's the context of what I'm, of the next bit of what I want to say. But in a way, I've spent more on the context of what I'm actually supposed to be talking about. But I think that's important because it's so against every bit of our culture, I think, certainly against mine, this whole idea of dwelling in this greater mandala of uselessness, that I think, I'm saying it as much for myself to repeat it again and again and again. What I'm really supposed to be talking about tonight is responsiveness. What I'm really supposed to be talking about is that the only way to grow is to, in life, in Dharma life, is to take responsibility. That's my real subject. But can you see how if I just started off saying the only way to grow is to take responsibility without saying all that other bit first, it would be a bit like, oh, you know. So remembering that what I've said about this, the Bodhisattva and the Leela and the greater mandala and the uselessness, I'm now saying that the only way to grow is to take responsibility. But that's got to be in the context of all this, yeah? And this is at every level, I think, that the only way to grow is to take responsibility. I think that's true. You might argue with me, but I think that's true. It's certainly been true for me. It's certainly been true and is true for me. It's how I've lived my Dharma life. And I think the best way to take responsibility is to take responsibility in relation to other people. Maybe in the end, that's the only way we can take real responsibility, is in relation to other people. So in my own Dharma life, what I've tried to do, I suppose what I've tried to do is always say yes, really. I've always tried to say yes whenever I'm asked to do something, especially if it's something that I think I can't do. I've always tried to do things that, in a sense, I've got no business doing because I'm not ready for them. The caveat is, to stop it being completely foolhardy, is that someone else thinks I am ready for it. Yeah. So if somebody, especially somebody that I respect and admire, asks me to do something and thinks I'm ready to do it, I've tried to always say yes. Usually in relation to someone else asking me, because although sometimes it's my own kind of inner self that sort of asks me. Do you ever get that? But I get it quite a lot, where you know something needs to be done and you think, oh yeah, that really needs to be done, I hope somebody does it soon, and then I realise, oh crikey, like it's going to be me. Then I suddenly realise, oh god, it's me, I'm the one to do it. I bet I'm just going, no, please, no, you know. And but at the same time, I know that to sort of squash that bit of me that knows really is me, it kind of would be to betray my own life, you know. It'd be to betray my own growth. So that's how I've lived my Dharma life, and still try to. I probably shouldn't say this out loud, or then I'll be held to it even more. Is to try and take on things that are bigger than me that I think I'm probably not ready for, and in a way often I'm not ready for. You sort of get ready, you learn how to do it in the doing of it. And I think the thing about responsibility, especially if it's in relation to other people, the key thing is you want to take on things that you can't back out of, because you want to back out of it. Well, I do all the time, you know, I want to change my mind because it proves to be bigger than I even thought it was going to be. But you can't back out of it if you've committed yourself. I think, yeah, or certainly it wouldn't be very good to back out of it. I think when one takes on responsibility, especially in relation to other people, the first sort of transformative level of it is that you see the consequences of your actions more clearly. I find that's really, really valuable. I'm not very good at seeing the consequences of my own actions, and maybe in a way none of us are. It's really hard to see the consequences of your actions, really hard to see that one has an effect on the world. I think it's really easy to just think, oh, well, it's just like me, you know, it's just little me inside. What does it exactly matter what it is? As long as you know, I'm not talking about grossly unskillful things, but just all those things, you know, that one does. And I think for growth, it's you have to see the consequences of your own actions, especially the unskillful ones, but maybe the skillful ones as well. And taking responsibility has really helped me in that. It's really it's a horrible process, seeing the effects of one's own actions, especially the unskillful ones. It's quite it's a humiliating process. I had this the other day, I've had hundreds of examples of in my life. I was leading a retreat and with a number of other people, but I was kind of heading it up, and I got myself in a bit of a flap. I got one of the days I was in this really anxious sort of state of mind. I don't know, I was just anxious about everything, all the little things I get anxious about, the biscuits weren't out right, or the thing, you know, all these little things that I thought were making the retreat not, you know, weren't proper, you know, this was my retreat, and I wanted everything to be perfect, and I got in a bit of an anxious state, and then I thought, oh dear, that wasn't very good, Subhadramati, you're supposed to be leading the retreat. You weren't, you know, that wasn't very nice for the rest of your team and maybe some other people as well. So at the end of the day, I said to the team, I said, well, look, I'm really sorry. I was really anxious then, and that wasn't very good, and I don't want to be like that again. And particularly one of the team, Pranyumanas, I was particularly sorry in relation to him because he had got the brunt of it. And he did something that only a very good spiritual friend does, and I was very grateful for it, but it was very, very painful at the time. He said, that's great, Subhadramati. He said, I really, really accept your apology. I'm quite sort of moved by that. And so I thought, oh, good, he's accepted my apology. And I think I'd even got up to go. He said, just like sit down another minute longer. He said, I just want to tell you the effect of that on other people. And I was like, oh, do you have to? And he did have to. But it was so kind. I'd really want to stress that it was with such love. It was not at all, he wasn't blaming me. Now, this is really important, that he wasn't saying, well, I want to tell you. He had completely accepted this apology. And he really was being a friend to me. I felt like about this size, you know, though, when I realised a bit, it helped me to see more deeply the effect that it had. But of course, that strengthened my resolution to really properly put conditions into place that hopefully won't happen again. Up until then, I'd been full of good intentions, but I think Pranyumanas reflecting it back like that, I thought, okay, it's not just good intentions, you've got to actually like change your ways, Super Ramati. So that was very good. But do you see how that came out of it came out of taking responsibility? If I hadn't been leading that retreat in the first place, you know, I'd have just been a little person in the corner meditating away. That would have been fine. You know, I wouldn't have got into any trouble. But getting into trouble was, in fact, part of the growth, especially when you're surrounded by friends. So that's the first level, that taking responsibility within, of course, this greater mandala, hopefully, helps us grow. But there's a deeper level again, which is the existential level, and we'll Jnanavaksha and I will go more into this as the weeks come. And the more existential level of this is that, well, what we're trying to do in our Dharma life is we're trying to go be completely beyond this duality, aren't we? If there's me in here and there's the world out there, yeah? We're trying to go beyond that. And how this is often talked about is we're trying to sort of break down the subject-object duality. That's the sort of classic way of talking about it. Maybe breakdown isn't even quite right. We're trying to transcend the subject-object duality. That's probably better. Now, what Bhante and all kind of all Buddhist teachers worth their salt would say, if you're trying to go to beyond that, you have to do that via the object, i.e. yourself, yeah? You have to, no, that's the wrong way around. Yes, no, it's the, sorry, start again. I'm getting all muddled up. Right, subject, object. You have to do it via the object. You have to put the other person first, in other words, because we're so used to, we habitually have ourselves at the center of everything, yeah? You can't break it down. You can't break it down from in here. Yeah, you have to try and break it down. Transcend's actually better than break down. From out there, as it were, by your relation to the other, yeah? You might think, well, if you know, you might think, okay, you've got subject, object, why not start in here? But actually, the argument is you have to start in relation to the other, because we've that one-sided tendency is so strong, it's so deeply strong, it's kind of, it's sort of why we're here in the first place. Yeah, it's not, it's like we're hardwired to have that one-sided tendency. If we're going to break or transcend that one-sided tendency, we have to do it by looking towards the other, yeah? That's the more existential value of this practice of growth by taking responsibility. Yeah, another way of putting it is that you, I, cannot get enlightened. Yeah, it can only be you plus others. Yeah, it can only be you in relation to others. Another way again of putting it is that the only thing that stands in our way of enlightenment is that dichotomy. That's the thing that stands in the way, yeah? So if we don't try and transcend that, we can never, enlightenment's impossible, yeah? I hope I'm managing to put this into words. I'm sure Jnanavaksha can do this much better. He's shaking his head. Maybe just try and remember, if I haven't put it very well, that you, I cannot get enlightened. It's a literal impossibility, because if one holds to that notion of I, that there is a real me in here, then but sort of by definition, you're not transcending that subject and object dichotomy, which is what enlightenment consists of. Okay, that's, I've managed to say it properly. Yeah. So that's the deepest level of why, well, to take us full circle, why Ratnasambhava's hand reaching out is the very thing that's creating the jewel of enlightenment, yeah? And the jewel of enlightenment is the very thing that's meaning that the hand can reach out even further, yeah? And the same with Avalokiteshvara. That's why the hand that's churning the beads on that rosary is creating the bodhicitta, and then the bodhicitta's meaning that that rosary can keep turning, yeah? So I'm going to leave it there for this week. I want to really keep encouraging you to keep practicing, if you can call it a practice, doing nothing. Really try and do that as well as your meditation. Just have 5 minutes, even 10 minutes, but even five, just sitting in your chair, cup of tea is allowed, but just doing nothing, being purposeless, not being useful, not justifying your existence. You don't have to justify it. Keep meditating, of course, and work against this one-sided tendency by responding, by allowing yourself to be moved by other people, and by responding to them, and by doing things that in a certain sense you think are beyond you, yeah, by putting yourself in relation to other people, taking responsibility in relation to other people, sort of beyond what you think you can do, and then holding to that, yeah, allowing the responsibility to hold you to that. Okay, good. So that's all for this week. Next week, Jnanavarta is going to be continuing this theme and continuing re-emphasizing the whole context of the greater mandala, the sphere of uselessness, but talking about how we engage with world issues, world difficulties even. Well, we're thinking it's particularly apt. We've got the whole Extinction Rebellion couple of weeks on just now. How do we engage with world issues like that, whichever way you think of that, and all the other sort of issues that the world throws at us and throws to us, and doing that within this bigger sphere, not letting our engagement with those things be spectacular failures, yeah? So that's next week from Jnanavarta, so hopefully see you there. Thank you.